You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. From Leslie M.M. Bloom comes In the Details, with photographs by Matt Holyoke. What you should know about Erdem Moralioglu, a panoply of eccentric biographical data refashions designer for Regal Romantics. In 2013, hundreds of thousands of people watched as Texas State Senator Wendy Davis filibustered a restrictive abortion bill for more than 11 hours. The vast audience was enraptured, but Erdem Moralioglu had an additional reason to be excited. Davis was, to his astonishment, wearing an Erdem dress. "I was so proud," he recalls. "I'd never dressed someone for filibustering before, ever." Perhaps he shouldn't have been surprised. Since opening his eponymous house in 2005, the half-British, half-Turkish fashion designer, 40, has been donned by other politicos, Michelle Obama among them, Hollywood royalty, Kate Blanchett, Michelle Williams, and actual royalty, including Kate Middleton and royal-in-training Meghan Markle, who says she's been wearing Erdem for years. His dresses are feminine studies in contrast, with mixed textiles and bold embellishments. And while he does both high, Bergdorf Goodman, Harvey Nichols, and low, H&M, his heart, he says, lies in fine craftsmanship. Here, Erdem Moralioglu talks about his first fashion, fascinations, and the quiet ways he addresses the tumult of today's political landscape. He grew up in a Montreal suburb, the child of two immigrants. His father hailed from Turkey and his mother from England. "My father was always cooking Turkish dishes, eggplant and hummus, and working out homesickness through his kitchen." He describes himself, however, as a dangerous and sometimes intolerable cook. He has a twin sister, now a news producer at the BBC. "My fascination with the female species came from having someone who was part of me, but the opposite sex." Some of his childhood activities were comparatively unusual. While everyone else was playing hockey, he instead watched Hitchcock and Merchant Ivory films in his family's basement. Seeing Helena Bonham Carter in a puff sleeve had a deep psychological effect, and fashion television on Sundays. "If you needed to find 10-year-old me, I was watching YSL and Galliano, cross-legged on the floor." "He was a Boy Scouts dropout. My parents didn't know what to do with me, so they put me in a pottery class with a lot of retired older women." His first job, packing freezers at a local Marks and Spencer. His earliest experiments with fashion, "I went through color phases. In first grade, I only wore yellow. Then I had a blue phase, like Picasso, head to toe. I would have to wear a specific shade of royal blue." These days, he's in a gray phase. His daily uniform, which usually includes tailored gray trousers and a gray merino wool sweater, more or less reflects the state of the world. While he doesn't see himself as a political designer, "I find it impossible not to question and observe what's happening around me." To that end, his East Meets West Summer 2017 collection celebrated his diverse background. "It felt timely to explore my heritage with two parents from different countries, cultures, and religions." He recently became engaged to his longtime partner, architect Philip Joseph, who proposed to him at the V&A Museum in London. "I didn't know what was going on. I just thought we were going for breakfast, but I got a ring instead." He did eventually get his breakfast as well. He collects photography books and works by both contemporary and historical photographers, including Wolfgang Tillmans, Ann Collier, and Cecil Beaton. He admits to watching truly bad television, including Don't Tell the Bride, a British reality television show in which grooms have to organize an entire wedding without consulting their brides. "That one's especially vice-like," he says happily. If he weren't a designer, he would have a bookstore, but I wouldn't be able to sell them or give them away, so I'd be a terrible bookstore owner. That's what I would be. The book he frequently rereads, Portraits and Observations by Truman Capote. He also has a sweet tooth for Tennessee Williams plays. I find him hypnotizing. His lucky talisman, my father's plain navy blue skinny tie that he wore at university in Switzerland. The woman who most epitomizes beauty to him, his mother. Like him, she wore a daily uniform, a men's button-down shirt, a full denim skirt, penny loafers, and red lipstick. Yet for Adem, it was her perfect, extraordinary openness and questioning mind that was beautiful. He despises nicknames, and what's more, I don't like the shortening of names either. I call Philip, Philip. Where he feels most at home, in his design studio in London's Shoreditch neighborhood. His mantra, keep calm and carry on, although it rarely does calm me. And that was Leslie M.M. Bloom interviewing Erdem Moralioglu. Now, this from James Walcott, Spy Anxiety. Thanks to Vladimir Putin, the Cold War is hot again. Nowhere has it seemed more real than in FX's The Americans, now kicking off its last season. Opening photo illustration by Mike McQuaid. Cold Warriors, Carrie Russell and Matthew Reese as married KGB spies in The Americans. The Cold War is the comeback geezer of dramatic genres, the original Minotauri Winter is Coming, the genre that gave us Doomsday Nailbiters, Failsafe, Let It Rip Satire, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, Cold Sweat, Fever Dreams, The Manchurian Candidate, and Penitential Studies in Betrayal, The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, went moribund almost overnight after the Berlin Wall crumbled in 1989. The evil empire that President Ronald Reagan decried had lost its bear claws and the fearful hold on our imagination that, later, Islamic terrorism would so ably resupply. People began to express nostalgia for the simpler days of arms races and superpower standoffs. But with the rise of Vladimir Putin, the former KGB lieutenant colonel and judo master, whose mirthless smile projects a Stalinist chill of the Cold War genre, emerged from retirement. A spate of films with an authentic restoration patina ushered viewers back to the good bad old days of microfilm, floodlit checkpoints, and sinister loitering under the lamppost. The Good Shepherd, 2006, loosely draped on the life and career of sepulchral spy master James Jesus Angleton. Bridge of Spies, 2015, Steven Spielberg's rich mahogany docudrama about the U-2 spy plane incident, with Tom Hanks representing truth, justice, and the American way as only he can, and Atomic Blonde, 2017, a kinetic thriller set in 1989 Berlin that serves primarily as a fight club for Charlize Theron at her most stylishly badass, as she disaggregates enemies with gun, blade, and stiletto heel. Whatever the qualities of such movies, however, they can't match the roomy stretchiness of long-form television, which does a superior job of immersing character, motive, and decision-making under a prolonged, tight focus stress test. The actors, becoming so intimately familiar over time that we can read their faces, parse their pauses, share their apprehension. The surveillance culture of Stasi, the East German intelligence operation, continues to exert fascination, as witness Deutschland 83, Sundance TV, and The Same Sky, Netflix, both excellent. But the Cold War retro that means the most to us, here in the land of the free and the home of the nervous, is, of course, The Americans, FX, which is kicking off its final rotation this month after 5 seasons of spying on the Defense Department, outfoxing the FBI, seducing vulnerable targets, cramming corpses into suitcases, and modeling a flotilla of unflattering wigs. Created by Joe Weisberg, a former CIA officer, The Americans could have easily been played for dark irony, an inversion of family values. Philip and Elizabeth Jennings, Matthew Reese and Carrie Russell, and their two offspring, Henry, Kedrick Salati, and Paige, Holly Taylor, present a brochure image of a perfectly balanced nuclear family. With Elizabeth, an MTV-era update of wholesome TV mom Donna Reed. But this mom and dad, when not attending parent-teacher conferences, are Russian agents, a couple of commies, whose marriage was arranged as part of their work snoop sleigh on behalf of the motherland. Expert infiltrators, they report to a handler. who for a number of reasons was the rabbinical Gabriel, Frank Langella, offering soothing words of comfort and guidance as he passed along instructions from Moscow Center. Living across the street is an FBI counterintelligence agent, Stan, played with his usual sneaky, beaky canniness by Noah Emmerich. He and Philip became buds, popping brewskis and shooting the breeze the way buds do. The contrast and conflict between the spiffy appliance shine of American optimism, they tell you everything, but when you see it, it just seems brighter, remarks Philip in the pilot, and the bruised depths of the brooding Russian soul contend in every episode, abraded by the constraints of time management. Only so many hours in a day, and it's tough making sure the kids attend to their homework before heading out to plant a debugging device in some adulterer's hotel suite. To be an ace spy is to master the art of compartmentalization, and with each new season of The Americans, the compartments multiplied as the mission load increased. So much collateral damage, poor Martha, poor Nina, so much accumulated guilt, and so much to keep straight when they're flipping from one alias to another like quick change artist. Moreover, The Americans doesn't settle for a binary showdown between capitalism and communism, stars and stripes versus hammer and sickle, but complicates its clash of creeds by introducing the granola idealism of Christian outreach, personified by the insufferably folky Pastor Tim, and the extreme cut-the-crap individualism of Werner Erhard's Est movement. The Est meetings with Philip and Stan, sitting like parishioners, are among my favorite scenes in the show, because they seem the least plot integral, inserted because the creators found them compelling, a dissonant break from the overarching obligations of answering to one's masters. These Est interludes speak to the sense that, whichever side you're on, you're being held captive by the misery you've chosen. Where most spy dramas concern themselves exclusively with the mental toll of remaining undercover, the morale depletion over time, The Americans lays a heavy stress on the physical trauma, the literal body blows. What makes The Americans the most contemporary of spy dramas, despite its Reagan-era setting, is its centering of the female body as predator, target, and battle zone. As a self-defense fighter, Elizabeth is a far fiercer punishment inflictor than Philip. And not just because of Russell's dance training, her ferocity in close combat, the velocity of her strike force, is character-driven, a fury rooted in violation. In a flashback in the series pilot, Elizabeth, a young trainee in her native Russia, is pressed face down to the floor and raped by a KGB operative who tells her years later, before he gets his neck rotated permanently out of alignment, that forced entry with the trainees had been one of the perks of his rank. After ditching his remains in a wastewater pool, Elizabeth and Philip go at it hot and heavy in the car, as aroused by murder as an itchy James M. Cain couple, nailing the nexus of sex and death that animates their animal senses. Pain and pleasure are often indistinguishable in The Americans. The horrific extraction of Elizabeth's broken tooth without anesthesia, since an emergency trip to the dentist might blow her cover, was photographed with a writhing intimacy and intensity that was like a pain orgasm, two pairs of eyes locked in unholy communion. With each season, Elizabeth's physicality becomes more balletically gaunt, more bone-shadowed, more of the scaffolding on which the show hangs. It is the female body in peril and resisting force that bonds Elizabeth and Paige, despite the usual mother-teenage-daughter frictions. In the pilot episode, we see Paige, only 13, being rapily eyed and verbally slathered over by a hulking dude who seems to collect underage girls as trophies. It's hunting season on the young and vulnerable. Years later, she's scoped as fresh meat by a couple of muggers who converge on her and her mother. In a flash, Elizabeth Coldcocks the first, and when the other pulls a knife, disarms him and slashes him across the throat with his own blade. This isn't something you pick up taking self-defense classes at the Y. Paige is stunned, confused, and yet impressed, as any good daughter would be at discovering her mother is Callie reborn. Once Elizabeth begins coaching Paige in kicking, punching, and blocking to protect herself on the street, it's a preliminary lesson in grooming her to become a Russian operative herself, a homegrown, sweet-faced, wide-eyed little traitor. For this farewell season, the Americans hops ahead 3 years to 1987, where we'll witness Paige carrying on the family tradition of spycraft and deception under Elizabeth's tutelage, elevating Take Your Daughter to Work Day to a whole nother existential dimension. Kids, they grow up fast, and before you know it, they're helping you hoist a body into the back of a van. Letter from England. In the bag. Julie Dean started the Cambridge Satchel Company to pay her kids' school fees, and the bags took off. Then the big money experts got involved. Dean's marriage cratered, and sales tanked. So she went back to Basics by Sarah Ellison. Opening photograph by Jason Bell. Executive suite, the entrepreneur Julie Dean near her company's headquarters in Cambridge, England. 1. Rise and Fall. In May 2015, Julie Dean, a mother of two and a respectable and practical British woman, was about to take a trip she had never envisioned for herself. At the invitation of Jack Ma, the Chinese billionaire, Dean was setting off for Shanghai for Alibaba's first conference on women and entrepreneurship. At the conference, alongside Dean, was Arianna Huffington, who was promoting her Thrive Global initiative, as well as actress Jessica Alba and the Queen of the Netherlands. Dean would practice Tai Chi with Ma on his private island off the coast of Hangzhou before the trip was over, but she was also in the midst of a rapid expansion of a business called the Cambridge Satchel Company, which she and her mother had started 7 years earlier in her kitchen, with a robust capitalization of £600. They had sought to bring back the traditional British school satchel and had become wildly successful, so much so that Dean had recently sold part of her company to a private equity firm that had pumped her small operation full of professional managers and consultants, all of whom were beginning to irritate her. On that afternoon in May, on the eve of her trip, they were discussing ideas about how to decorate Cambridge Satchel's first shop for men, which was opening in about a month. Dean recalled the presentation to me when I visited her last summer in Cambridge. We sat in a cafe just outside King's College, and two doors down from the Cambridge Satchel Company store she had opened just a few years earlier. After the designers had finished, they asked, as she remembered, "What do you most like about this?" And I said, "Nothing. I don't like anything about it." And they got really huffy. They got really, really huffy. But Dean was feeling huffy, too. It didn't feel like our shop anymore. Dean cut the meeting short and asked the designers to send to her by email every detail of the store they were designing so she could approve or reject each one. And so it was when I was in China and emailing them from my hotel room at 2 a.m, and I was saying to myself, "That bloody Ariana's been sleeping for the last 7 hours." Dean has an oval face, wavy dark hair, a soft frame, and a sharp sense of humor. When I spent the day with her, she outlined for me the rise, the fall, and the comeback of her business, a story that illustrates the entrepreneurial traps inherent in trying to hold on to a vision while growing too fast. Cheery and no-nonsense, with a chipped pedicure and a degree in biophysics, Dean is as unexpected a figure as can be in the fashion industry. My train from London had arrived slightly late, and Dean quickly shepherded me into her car and drove to Caius College, Stephen Hawking's old school, where Dean had just been named honorary fellow, one of only 3 women to hold the title. She was congratulated continually as we had lunch in the long and elaborate dining room she had helped design 30 years ago when she was a student there. After graduating, she returned home to Swansea in Wales to care for her ailing father. "There weren't any scanning electron microscopes in Swansea," Dean told me, "so she went to work for an accounting firm. The experience was fortunate. She would need accounting." Next photos, startup. Dean's daughter Emily and her son Max during a modeling shoot 2008. And a sketch of what would become the company's logo. 2. Inspiration. The year was 2008, and Dean was living in a village outside Cambridge. She was married to a management consultant and had 2 children, Emily, 8, and Max, 6. Dean had given up her own career in accounting when Emily was born, and had been a stay-at-home mom ever since. Emily had grown increasingly quiet throughout the year. One day, Dean arrived at the school to pick up her daughter and saw her being bullied by some of the other girls in her class. "She wasn't fighting back," Dean told me. Like countless other mothers, Dean found a way to blame herself. "Because I was a stay-at-home mom, and I am very energetic, and I like to do my projects, I would seize everything that I could do with the children." She created miniature gardens in the lids of glass jars. She made vegetables out of Play-Doh. They'd be bored, and I'd still be making cauliflower. All of this meant, Dean continued, that occasionally Emily would miss a reference that a school friend made to EastEnders, or she would be overly enthusiastic about the latest miniature garden she and her mother had created. Those small moments, in Dean's thinking, were enough to create a flare point of difference. Dean promised her daughter that she'd go somewhere else in the fall. When Emily was admitted to a private school, I just sort of asked about the school fees, fell over backwards, and picked myself up and thought, "Right, that's a lot," Dean told me. "But it's almost easier when you don't have a choice. 1 year of school cost £12,000, times two, actually, because she couldn't send one child without the other. The couple did not have money to spare. In the previous year, however, Dean had earned £600 running a medical conference at Caius College. She quickly created a spreadsheet in which she listed possible business ideas that could turn £600 into £24,000. When I noted that £600 seemed like an awfully small amount to start a business with, Dean replied, "If you hang around too much with Silicon Valley types, you think that $1 million is nothing. If you hang around with normal, hard-working people, £600 isn't nothing. You can do actually quite a lot with £600. And she did. She put it into satchels. Dean had been looking for a traditional school satchel for some while. "I was sick to death of the rubbishy school bags that they have today," she explained. "They are," she said, "poorly made, and typically decorated with licensed characters that feel old after one season." She remembered the leather school satchel that she'd carried for 7 years when she was a student. "It looked better when I finished my upper sixth than it did when I was starting." But when she went to shop for one, she scrolled pages and pages through Google, and you just could not get those bags anymore. She moved quickly. This was all in a day. I mean, this is not like, let's plan a business over a year or something, and launch it with a big party and pay famous people to come. It wasn't like that. It was, okay, so that's the one we're going to do. And my mom was there, and she said, "Well, if that's the one you're going to do, you're going to have a name." I was like, "Good point. We're going to have a name. How about, since we're in Cambridge and we sell satchels, the Cambridge Satchel Company?" Picked up a half an hour on that one. Dean is so self-deprecating it can almost feel elusive, but it's possibly the effect. But it's possible the effect is just British understatement, or I've been spending too much time with Silicon Valley types. Next came the design of the satchel itself. In my head, there is only one way a satchel can look, and so I just made the first prototype with two cereal boxes and covered it in brown paper and drew some buckles on it. Dean figured the task of finding a manufacturer would be easy, but it wasn't. She had rejected the concept of having the bags made by an artisanal craft shop. What that means is they'll make something, but it will cost so much that school children could never buy it as a school bag, and you could never add on any kind of margin. Eventually, Dean found a random Scottish school that listed leather school satchels in their prospectus. I was like, "Hallelujah, it's the Holy Grail. This is what I need." She called the school and asked for the school outfitter. She called the outfitter, a small shop in Scotland. The owner was a decent fellow, but he would not divulge his manufacturer. Dean would not accept no for an answer. The person who gets it, the person who is going to win, is the person who wants it more, you know, she told me, by way of explaining how she handled the situation. What she proceeded to do was call the shop every half hour to ask the owner questions about his satchels. What color do you do? She asked. He responded that he made the bags in a chestnut color. Dean approved of this. Because traditional school satchels are in chestnut, she said. You only have to look at the opening of the Narnia PlayStation game, and they're running in the underground, and two of them have got the satchels on. Chestnut. She put the phone down, and then half an hour later called him again. Do you have navy satchels? No, because they're chestnut. Oh, that's too bad. Okay. Dean phoned him yet again. Do you have red satchels? Because I think red satchels would look so swift. They would look really, really nice. Do you have them? No. On it went, every 30 minutes. Midway through the second day, the man asked, "How many questions do you have?" Dean said to him, "You know, that is the really funny thing. I feel like I have literally got thousands of questions about satchels. And the really weird thing is, they only ever seem to come one at a time." The shop owner gave her the name of his manufacturer, who was located in the town of Hull. She drove there immediately and made a deal. 3. The British It Bag. By the end of that first summer in 2008, Dean and her mother were selling 6, sometimes 10 bags a day from her house. Neither of them took a salary. Marketing was done online and by word of mouth. Meanwhile, Dean settled on an arrangement with the headmaster of her daughter's new school to pay the fees monthly instead of by semester, so that she could write checks on a rolling basis as money came in. She and her mother packaged the bags they sold in tissue, brown paper, and string. They discovered that the garden center dumpster had boxes used for packing bulbs that happened to be the right size for packing satchels. The early bags sold for about £60 apiece. Before long, Cambridge Satchel attracted the attention of Urban Outfitters, and Dean had to expand her manufacturing capabilities to service the orders. She was still operating out of her kitchen, and now she added 2 more manufacturers, one outside of Edinburgh, Scotland, and another in Norfolk. Dean and her mother would pack the bags with small personal touches, like a dog biscuit for a customer who had a dog, or a chocolate bar with a handwritten apology if a bag arrived late. It really sort of set us apart, Dean told me. She paid close attention to the emails she received. If somebody was at dailymail.co.uk, straight away I would email them and say, "I didn't know you were working for the Daily Mail. Can you please tell me how do people get their products featured in your pages?" Dean contacted fashion bloggers and sent them bags for free. Sophie Ellis-Bextor, a British singer and songwriter, ordered a bag, and Dean called her to thank her personally. Dean asked if she could publicize the fact that Ellis-Bextor had bought a bag, and Ellis-Bextor agreed. Soon there were photos of her all over the Cambridge Satchel website. Photos of the British fashion designer and model Alexa Chung carrying an 11-inch classic satchel in navy were appearing in the British press. An early customer was a fashion editor at LUK. If Dean could produce some bright-colored bags, the editor said, she believed she could get them into a photo shoot for the magazine. Dean was still working out of her house, and she sent one of her bags to a Brooklyn-based blogger, Jessica Quirk, author of the blog What I Wore, and ask Quirk to help her run a contest on her reader's favorite color of bag. Quirk posted a photo of a circle of Cambridge satchel bags and solicited opinions. She passed those opinions back to Dean, and the result was what became Kelly Green. Dean soon launched the Floro collection of bright fluorescent-colored bags, which she sent to fashion bloggers in time for New York Fashion Week in 2010. That same year, the New York Times identified Cambridge Satchel as the British It Bag. Next photo, getting the goods. Satchels on display at the Cambridge shop, and, far right, the shop's classic exterior. The business was taking off, and Dean moved operations out of her kitchen. Suddenly, her bags were being stocked by large department stores, and she was being approached about partnerships with Comme des Garçons and Erdem. That presented a problem of its own. "I had a backlog of 16,000 bags," Dean remembered. Her three factories could make between 100 and 150 a week. It was untenable, and new orders were pouring in every day. Dean contacted another factory, Leicester Remedials and Sewing, which agreed to take on an additional production. She brought the manufacturer from Hull to train the new manufacturer and provided her own leather, patterns, and knives to cut the satchels. What followed is in dispute, but Dean told me that her new manufacturer was stealing the leather and designs and selling satchels under a new brand name, Zatchels. "It's like seeing your child with different parents," she said. Dean sued Zatchels' parent company, Leicester Remedials and Sewing, in 2011, seeking compensation and damages for breach of contract and the unlawful use of goods. Zatchels eventually paid Cambridge Satchel an undisclosed sum to settle the case out of court. When I ask Zatchels about Dean's allegations, Dean Clark, one of its directors, wrote in an email, "We have no wish to engage in this ridiculous rubbish with Julie Dean, whose only wish seems to be to destroy all UK competition." Whatever the reasons behind the bad blood and legal wrangling, the upshot is that Dean decided to set up her own manufacturing operation in Leicester. At this point, during Dean's recollections, her son, Max, now 16, joined us at the cafe near the large Cambridge satchel store, where we spotted a group of Chinese tourists who had come to see King's College. They would buy 7 or 8 bags each. Max seemed wholly amused by his mother. He's well acquainted with the timeline of the business and remembers the need to open a new factory in a hurry. He also remembers pitching in to help pack the bags in time for the Paris shows in 2011. At their most anxious point, Cambridge Satchel had back orders for 36,000 bags. Dean's daughter Emily, the one who had inspired the business in the first place, was tasked with helping to respond to all the angry emails from customers demanding their bags. There were moments when the fates seemed to be conspiring against them. One day, when they were hauling their equipment out of a rental facility and into a more permanent location, the moving trucks were blocked from crossing town because King Richard III's bones had been discovered under a parking lot, and all traffic was stopped. 4. Too much success. In 2012, Dean was featured in a Google television ad for its Chrome web browser that told the story of Dean's scrappy origins. She became as well known as the Satchels themselves. Later that year, Samantha Cameron, the wife of then-Prime Minister David Cameron, hosted an event at Downing Street for the winners of Red Magazine's Hot Women Awards. And Dean, who had won that year for entrepreneurship, was a guest. In 2013, Dean collaborated with British designer Vivienne Westwood and opened two brick-and-mortar stores, one in Cambridge and one in London. She was invited to Buckingham Palace to collect the Queen's Award for Enterprise, International Trade from Queen Elizabeth. That same year, Mad Men's Matthew Weiner chose Cambridge satchel bags as wrap presents for the show's actors. At the end of the year, she joined a delegation to China, led by Prime Minister Cameron. In early 2014, Dean received her first private equity investment, $21 million from Index Ventures, which had previously backed the digital fashion retailers Net-a-Porter and Nasty Gal, as well as Moleskine, the Milan-based notebook company. Index acquired a minority stake, and Dean announced that she would redesign the website, bring on guest bloggers to build engagement with customers, open new stores, and double the company's sales. On the heels of that announcement, she was made an officer of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. Prince Charles awarded her the OBE at a Buckingham Palace ceremony. Her charming kitchen table business appeared poised to take over the world. She had big plans for China and the U.S., and the money and professional management promised by Index Ventures made expansion feel assured. Instead, overhead costs ballooned and sales plummeted. Rather than being involved in the day-to-day business, Dean took a step back and was updated every month by her new management team. The company increased the kinds of bags on offer, but did so in a race to reach revenue targets, not with the same fastidious care as before. In 2013, Cambridge Satchel had generated nearly £13 million in sales. The following year, in 2014, sales fell to £10 million, and in 2015, they slid to £7.5 million. The company had become deeply unprofitable. With an operating loss that year of more than £5 million. It didn't go well the 2 years after the investment, Dean told me. There were a couple of reasons, and one was that my 24-year marriage fell apart, and I didn't see it coming. The other one was that when you get an investment, and you think they know how to scale, and all these kinds of things, you're almost saying, I'm taking this investment because I don't know enough how to do it. And along with that, you just start taking advice that just shakes your confidence in your own abilities. What had set Cambridge Satchel apart, Dean told me, was its attention to detail. People with experience at companies with $100 million in sales, the kind of people who came in to help her company expand internationally, are not the kind of people who dive in and roll up their sleeves and do stuff themselves. Money was wasted on everything from consultants to caterers. Dean told me of custom-designed crackers for the launch party of a new flagship store in Covent Garden, along with grapes and bits of cheese assembled into the shape of penguins. Penguins on sticks, we had those, Dean recalled. The launch party alone cost £100,000. Worse, the company began designing bags by committee, and customers could tell. There was a churn of creating new products for the sake of it, a Cambridge Satchel spokesperson told me candidly. Dean thinks back on all this as an exceptionally dark moment in her life. Using agencies to help her design her store was, she told me, sort of like saying you don't know yourself, so you've got to pay somebody to tell you what your shop should look like. It's like farming out your children. Next photo, royal treatment. Dean collects the Queen's Award for Enterprise, International Trade, presented by Queen Elizabeth, 2013. 5. Turnaround. By the summer of 2016, Dean had changed her C-suite executives. The Chief Financial Officer, the Chief Marketing Officer, and the Chief Technology Officer. She reasserted control over day-to-day operations and hired her own executive team. Rather than receiving monthly updates, she insisted on knowing what was happening every day. To stay connected with senior executives, she made heavy use of WhatsApp's group chat function and called her group table talk, an effort to hark back to those early days at her kitchen table. Meanwhile, Dean redoubled her efforts in China and took multiple trips to scout out the market. She now sells Cambridge satchel bags on Alibaba's Tmall, China's equivalent of Amazon. After the UK, China and the US vie to be Cambridge Satchel's second largest territory, and the company has expanded its offerings to include clutches and other accessories. Last year, it sold 9,000 units of its new poppy bag, a takeoff of a traditional doctor bag. In 2016, sales of Cambridge Satchel products edged back up to £11 million, and the company is poised to return to the black. This autumn, Dean launched a line of new products, starting with cashmere scarves and scented candles, under the name Cambridge Life. What Dean is selling is her very particular brand of English taste. Her inspiration for scented candles came from some she purchased at a spa during a low moment in her fortunes, candles that had vastly improved her mood. "Sometimes it is that simple," Dean told me, which struck me as a quintessentially British thing to say. As we parted, Dean was preparing to go to a garden party at Buckingham Palace with her mother, and she had rented hats for the occasion. She showed me both, each stylish, though not overdone. She may have ambitious plans for the future of the company, but she now knows she must stay very close to the business. Dean has started tentatively dating again, but her highly developed interest and taste sometimes get in the way, as she is the first to admit. She asked one man in the course of a date, "If you were an element on the periodic table, what would you be?" Meanwhile, her daughter, Emily, started university in the fall. It's easy to forget, but the whole point of starting a business had been to make it possible for Emily to go to the right kind of school. Well, it worked. "No matter what happens now," Dean said, "I accomplished what I set out to do."
Thank you.
This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.